When it comes to ensuring your company has top-notch security practices, things can get complicated fast. With Vanta, you can automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, HIPAA, and more. Vanta's market-leading trust management platform can help you unify security program management with a built-in risk register and reporting, and streamline security reviews with AI-powered security questionnaires. Over 7,000 fast-growing companies like Atlassian, Flow Health, and Quora use Vanta to manage risk and prove security in real time. You can watch Vanta's on-demand video at vanta.com/decoder to learn more. That's vanta.com/decoder.
Support for this podcast comes from another podcast. The world's most valuable resource, it's actually data. Our data, based on our behaviors, is frequently being gathered, tracked, stored, and sold. So what does this mean for us? Join host Rafi Krikorian for season 2 of Technically Optimistic, where he'll take you on a deep dive into how our data is being used and what we can do about it. From social media feeds to foundational human rights, Krikorian leads us into territories both familiar and unexpected with openness and genuine curiosity. New episodes of Technically Optimistic drop every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Decoder. I'm Neil Patel, editor-in-chief of The Verge, and Decoder is my show about big ideas and other problems. Here's a question for you. What platforms most shape the internet, and with it, our culture? Take a second. Name some names. I bet I can guess some of your answers. Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, TikTok. Some of you probably said Twitter and then caught yourself. That's a whole different episode. Those are all social media platforms, and they are what we think about when we think about algorithms and culture. But there's a much bigger algorithmic platform out there that shapes almost everything around it, and we basically take it for granted. I'm talking, of course, about Google Search. Google Search has more than 90% of the search market, and it's the primary starting point for most people using the internet outside of mobile apps. Google is the web, and that means the web is Google's platform. Now, if you've been listening to Decoder or The Vergecast for a while, you know that I am obsessed with Google Search, the web, and how both of those things might change in the age of AI. But to really understand how something might change, you have to take a step back and understand what it is right now. So today I'm talking with Verge Platforms reporter Mia Sato about Google Search, the industries it's created, and more importantly, how relentless search engine optimization, or SEO, has utterly changed the web in its image. Here's an example. Last month, HouseFresh, a small website dedicated to testing and reviewing air purifiers, published a blog post showing in detail how the scammy SEO practices of large publishers have captured most of the search traffic for air purifier reviews. For HouseFresh, this means they're not just competing for search traffic with real competitors like Consumer Reports or Wirecutter that actually review products, but also against a huge set of content farms pumping out SEO-targeted pages like what is the best air purifier, even if they've done no research or testing of their own. And it's not just scam sites. Big publishing companies all do this because they're trying to make a buck. See, a top spot on Google Search equals web traffic, and web traffic in theory equals money. And because Google has a monopoly on web search, you can start to see how the incentives to game Google align to change the web itself into something much worse than it was before. If it feels like we're not getting as high-quality information out of Google as we did in the past, it's because it's true. The web itself is getting overrun with low-quality pages. And with the rise of AI, we can't even trust that the information we do find was written or edited by a human being. Mia has been reporting specifically on Google Search for more than a year now, and she's published some fantastic pieces that we'll link to in the show notes about how Google has shaped the web and how the SEO industry has had a toxic effect on what we find. I love this topic, so Mia and I really got into why search results are so terrible now, what Google is trying to do about it, and why this is such an important issue for the future of the internet. Mia, welcome to Decoder.
Thank you.
You have been reporting on the internet, the web, and how SEO has been shaping the web for a long time. It feels like that is coming to a breaking point. And we can see evidence of that breaking point all over the place. Just a couple weeks ago, a site called HouseFresh, which is a site dedicated to air purifiers, wrote a pretty scathing blog post about just what the SEO monster of the internet is doing to their business. Can you tell us what was in that blog post?
Yeah. HouseFresh, which is this small independent website, it covers air quality, air purifiers, like the definition of a specialty site. It writes this long article basically saying how it has given up trying to rank highly in Google search results for the exact thing that people would want to read them for. So like best air purifier for pets. That is a thing that HouseFresh could exactly get an answer to you about. And it said like, these terms, we cannot even compete anymore because these big publishers like Rolling Stone or Better Homes and Gardens or BuzzFeed are consistently ranking above us. They used this example and then kind of zoomed out at the larger media landscape, showing how these big conglomerates, these big private equity-backed marketing firms that have all these different websites underneath them are using product recommendations, product reviews, quote unquote, as like this cash cow for traffic.
We should just disclose from the jump here. We run a reviews program. We have affiliate links on our website. Like that's a part of our business. We try to be very precious about it. But we're up against the same forces. And I would be remiss not to just point that out to the audience here. Like we exist in this ecosystem. Here's what I think about HouseFresh though. And I'm just curious for your perspective on this. The promise of the internet is someone who cares so much about air purifiers should be able to start a website about air purifiers and make that a business. There's something very wholesome about that. Like I have an air purifier review business because I care about this thing so much. Why is that under such pressure from Google? Like that seems like the core tension here. Why is it that you can't run an air purifier website without thinking about Google?
It's weird because Google also in its public documents presents the same promise, right? Like if you make good stuff, don't even worry about SEO or like don't even worry about the rankings. That is a very easy kind of hand-wavy way to dodge the reality, which is that there are all sorts of different incentives besides just make good stuff and people will read your stuff. The Google search page is a zero-sum game. If we are above another outlet, like they necessarily lose out on that spot. If you get pushed to the more results section or the second page or whatever, like you are not on the first and people are going to click the things that are above you. So the Google search incentives are way more complicated and way more ruthless than just like, you're good, you're smart at this one thing, and we want you to make good content about it. Like, that's just not the reality.
Does Google perceive that search page as making a bunch of value judgments?
I think anyone who has been on Google will say yes. Like, Google elevates specific things over other stuff, not just in how things are ranked, but like the snippets, these special like sidebars that they've introduced where Google is doing the editing, right? Like, they're deciding what part of an article is snipped, like in the snippet. That is Google's making. They also have a lot of documentation about what they look for quote unquote useful content or good websites. So they do have a whole set of rules about what they want. I think what we've seen and now what we feel as users is that publishers have bent over backwards to meet these requirements and these preferences of Google.
When you create a set of incentives, people will game those incentives. There's a very large industry of people out there dedicated to gaming Google search results, so their content gets up there on top of the first page. In theory, you get that first spot on the first page of Google search by being good at what you do. That's what Google wants. That's what it says it does. HouseFresh does the work to review a bunch of air purifiers. I love it. That's the promise of the internet. People who really care about the quality of air purifiers go review a ton of air purifiers and share their findings with the world. And I get it. That's something we do too. People who care a lot about cell phones are going to talk about cell phones and go to websites where people talk about cell phones. That is embracing the potential of the internet. But HouseFresh's blog post was all about how the small, passionate outlets are the ones being steamrolled by the SEO spam operations from the BuzzFeeds and CNNs and CNets, which are all playing a much more mercenary kind of search game. I wonder, why are bigger publishers with more resources trying to get in on that territory? And why isn't Google boosting sites like HouseFresh to counter that and provide better search results?
why do they want to get into it? Like money. There is this sort of like fetishization of like evergreen content, which is basically stuff that is not pegged to news that people will always search for. Best air purifier, best leggings, which is right now, I just checked it before we started talking. CNN is the top ranking organic result for best leggings. Why? What's going on? When you encounter CNN in that context on Google search, that is a very different context than if you were to check CNN in the morning to see what the news is. CNN has a whole, like, separate section of their site that is really hard to get to other than through search, that is all product reviews and recommendations. Best perfume for women, best cozy slippers. Like, this is a whole underbelly of that media operation that is specifically tailored only to Google searchers. Nobody is going on CNN's website and using the like search for the site searching for best leggings, right? This is simply catering to the Google audience. The thing about all of these sites is that they are loaded with affiliate ads. So every link you click and buy something from, CNN gets that kickback. It was a big part of the CNET operation. Other sites have this running in the background as well. There is content, if it's not affiliate links, it's like specifically tailored for things that people would search for. Good Housekeeping like regularly publishes lists of the 1,000 top baby names, and it is just a list of 1,000 names. And then like on top, a bunch of filler text about like, many people are naming babies Mia or whatever. Mia is actually a very popular name.
It's good. Well
right?
done.
Like, whatever. I'm not salty
every time,
about it.
Every time someone describes this game to me, I worry that we don't play it. I think I'm not ruthless enough to be like, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to pay for journalism by making a bunch of evergreen pages just for Google search, so that when someone is searching for best leggings, they will encounter us, potentially buy a pair of leggings, and I will collect some pennies from the affiliate link. That's the game, right? You want the pages to be cheap and abundant. You don't want to update them a lot because that costs money, because you need a person to do it. So you just have a list of best leggings, or you make the cheapest possible webpage, which is just a list of 1,000 names with Mia at the top. And you say, people will find this webpage and hopefully somehow they will pay us money for this webpage. And I can take that money and use it to pay some reporters. We don't play that game because I think that destroys our brand. But it doesn't seem like that's actually working out well for the media industry.
Well, that's what's really stupid, is it's like, why are you doing this? If the idea is that we are going to produce all this content that is trying to get people to purchase things, which that's, we should talk about that too. Like the idea that media companies are now primarily like vessel for delivering stuff to you to buy, like that's a whole other thing. But if we do take it at face value that this is the stuff that makes money, every site, every news outlet, every newspaper has a part that makes money and a part that maybe doesn't, and we're going to take the money-making stuff and pay for the expensive but worthwhile stories, reporting, reviews that are in the public interest, is that happening, right? Based on the outlets that are closing, that are doing layoffs, that are consolidating, like that doesn't seem to be true. It's a kind of like easy way to describe and explain why you would do this, but I'm not convinced that that's actually in practice happening.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll ask Mia why product recommendations specifically are such a huge problem with Google search right now.
Support for Decoder comes from Mint Mobile. Imagine you're at a very fancy, expensive restaurant, and as you're browsing the menu, wondering how you'll afford anything on it, you notice the filet mignon is a mere $10. At first you think jackpot, but then you immediately think, wait, what's the catch? Now, what do suspiciously cheap steaks have to do with your cell phone bill? Well, we're used to seeing quote-unquote great deals from overpriced wireless providers, and also thinking, what's the catch? But with Mint Mobile, there is no catch. For a limited time, their wireless plans are just $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. You can get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month. Go to mintmobile.com/decoder. That's mintmobile.com/decoder. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/decoder. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on an unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline. Because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Support for this show comes from Slack. You're a growing business, and you can't afford to slow down. If anything, you could probably use a few more hours in the day. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.
Welcome back. We're talking with Verge Platforms reporter Mia Sato about how e-commerce and digital media companies have collided in strange ways. Now, it's mostly because of Google search. But first, we should just say this clearly. You're going to hear us name a bunch of media companies, some of which are direct competitors to The Verge, because we're talking about something that we in the news business call a commerce department, which makes money using affiliate marketing. Those are links to retailers inside of articles that give the publisher a cut if the reader clicks and buys something. Almost every major publisher on the internet has affiliate links on its site. Very few of us are immune to the pressures of the digital media business overall. And The Verge and Vox Media have affiliate links as well. That's the reality of it. But just to be clear, at The Verge, we do in fact review every cell phone and laptop and every other product that we recommend you buy. And we have a very clear ethics policy that explains how we keep the pressures and the influence of our affiliate marketing team away from our editorial and reviews department. The ethics policy is on our website. We'll link to it. I encourage you all to go read it. Okay, let's get back into it. There are a handful of potential places where it is working. The Wirecutter, famously, was an affiliate-driven site. Brian Lamb, who I used to compete against when he was the editor-in-chief of Gizmodo, started the Wirecutter, and he said, we're just going to recommend one product. There will be one answer for every question you might have about what product to buy. We'll do the rigorous testing. We'll show you our work if we need to, but we're just going to tell you the answer, and you can buy it. And that will be our business model, and this makes sense because the affiliate clicks make sense. That presumes there is one answer to the review process. It also presumes that people coming to Google only want the one answer. What is the best mattress? What is the best couch? Which is a deeply subjective thing to answer. Do you think consumers are actually operating in that mode? Like, is this a successful way to evaluate the things that surround us?
Well, it's not helpful if the places that are publishing these things are not reviewing them in the first place. And this was a big part of the HouseFresh argument and frustration. These outlets without the expertise, without the specialty, are recommending products that there is little to no evidence that they actually tested. They don't show their work. They don't explain how their ranking system or rating system works. The reality is that it's just a bunch of links that make them money with words in between. Is that the way that people want to shop? Like, Maybe that's a way. I think the HouseFresh thing mentioned this too, was that before people know the exact thing they want to buy, they need to learn about all the other things that are out there. They need some sort of like top filter that maybe is a collection of, you know, a dozen leggings from CNN, and then they can go through and individually look at them and look at the price and look at the sizing and whatever, and then make a decision. Like, sure. But if it's being presented as, you know, CNN is co-signing this pair of leggings, CNN is saying that these Athleta leggings are the best ones, and they're not doing the adequate testing, like, that is obviously using the brand name in a way that HouseFresh is pissed about. And I don't blame them.
Google really emphasizes having a combination of expertise, experience, authoritativeness, and trustworthiness to boost your search ranking. The company calls this EEAT, and it's supposed to help ensure that good old-fashioned fake news doesn't get those first few slots. There are good reasons for emphasizing EEAT, and in particular, for preferencing trusted publishers. After all, Google's been burned before. Getting accurate COVID information to people in 2020 was a huge challenge. Making sure to return only accurate campaign and election information is still a huge challenge. And it's not great for Google when it accidentally helps scammers make money from misinformation and other kinds of fraud.
That opens Google up to liability, right? Like, of what do we do when we are pushing people to these literal fake news websites? Well, we should just push them instead to trustworthy outlets. This doesn't always work. Like, the obituary spam thing is an example where there's, they call it a data void, where there's not enough information about something. So then those shitty ones do kind of climb up and you're getting this AI generated stuff, this straight up fake information. But otherwise, I think Google is trying to evaluate these web pages based on their own internal guidelines. The guidelines are pretty specific about what they're looking for, what trust looks like, what kinds of elements should be on a web page. And the outlets that are able to do that the best are big media organizations that can employ people to go and change the published date on every single article, or ask all of their writers to write a new bio, as we did at The Verge, because it's good for Google. So there's obviously this like disparity in like what you as a small publisher can do versus what Vox Media can do, or the New York Times can do, or Healthline, which is owned by the same people who own CNET, like what they can do.
Even within that set of big publishers, some are vastly more ruthless than others. You spent a lot of time last year reporting on CNET, which was bought by a private equity company called Red Ventures. CNET was one of our most ferocious competitors several years ago. The private equity company basically said, oh, you've got a lot of Google authority. We can use that to put affiliate links everywhere or do automated pages about products or mortgage rates or whatever. And that sort of crushed the editorial of the property. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. Before Red Ventures had even purchased CNET, CNET was already doing quite well in Google. And the idea is, people are coming to CNET's website through Google. Why don't we produce more openings into this? Why don't we do mortgage rates of the day, which is something that CNET was publishing literally every single morning, like first thing in the morning, in an automated fashion. Then it was like, well, what if we did, what is a credit card? How do you open a credit card? What is a checking account? Like, these are real articles, right, that the outlet figured was profitable to do, that people would find the website by searching these things, and that CNET would be, you know, somewhere near the top. Gradually, you can see how that can expand just like endlessly to different product categories, different topics that has nothing to do with what CNET was founded on. It has nothing to do with technology, but it is sort of like, well, we're already ranking quite well for, you know, laptop reviews or phone reviews or best VPNs or whatever. So why don't we just expand this? We have this sort of ranking authority on Google. Google trusts this site as being a trustworthy, well, did now that it's, you know, I don't know. It's exactly what the House Fresh argument is that these big publishers are seeing their authority and taking advantage of it and just creating an endless mountain of content that is way worse than what something like House Fresh would produce.
That was a problem before AI, right? We're going to take a website, we're going to turn it into a content farm. We'll hire a bunch of people at least to do content farm stuff. Look at what's trending on Google, throw some copy and pictures together on a web page, publish it, hope it ranks. Maybe somebody signs up for a mortgage and we get a bunch of dollars. At least there were people in the mix there. It was like slow in its way, and you might be paying some people some pennies. Not saying it was great, but at least it was people. You add AI into this, and we're seeing it across publishers, including CNET. And it feels like the problem for Google is getting exponentially worse, right? The web is going to get flooded with garbage. You wrote about obituary spam. There are AI written obituaries of everybody all the time, which is crazy. And Google can't seem to tell them apart from real obituaries or even people who are still alive. Is this the breaking point for the web? Is there a way for Google to come through this? Is this just diminishing return for publishers and they'll stop because there's nothing left there?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're staring down the barrel of AI-generated results too, right? Like, search generative experience being on top of all of our results. It's interesting to me that the Google audience is both so important to publishers, apparently, and also that content is the first thing that gets automated and poorly. You care so much about scooping up this Google traffic, and yet you're using these AI tools to generate this sort of, you know, SEO chum, these rote explainer articles, these very boring, very bare minimum amount of content and about the bare minimum quality of information. It's this strange contradiction. Like, why would you outsource that to a machine if that is the thing that makes you money? This doesn't sound like valuing that audience. And that gets into a bigger question too of like, what do we make of people who find us via Google? Who are those people? Are they our audience? Are they Google users? I should say that when Google talks about the people that are coming to our site via their platform search, those are not The Verge readers. Those are searchers. Those are Google users. And I think that's a really important distinction where what are we doing when we're spending all this time producing this mountain of content for a search engine for users who might, you know, jump to our site, spend a couple minutes, and then never come back?
Do you think, as you've reported on some of these media companies in particular that have started doing AI publishing, does it appear that the people who run those companies know that turning yourself into an AI-powered supplier to Google is the end game? There's nothing past that, right? Like, once you do that, it feels like Google's just going to run its own AI. Google has better AI than a Geo Media or a CNET, right? Like, to some extent, those companies are just buying AI tools from Google to make AI content to feed back into Google. And it seems very obvious to me, at least, you might make a little bit of money in the meantime, but eventually Google's just going to run the AI itself and take all those companies out of the loop.
Yeah, I think that's like exactly what you said. It works for now. And for a lot of these publishers, that's good enough, which is a shame. It's why, you know, you see places like CNET go through rounds and rounds and rounds of layoffs that have completely gutted the newsroom, the reviews section. These people who have been there for a really long time, either being out of a job because they got laid off or they leave because they cannot handle it anymore. This relentless, sort of ceaseless optimizing for Google, only for Google. We are writing things that Google searchers are looking for. That is demoralizing. That's also not journalism if you only do that. I'm curious what these media executives think they're doing for themselves in the future. The other part is, like other platform algorithms, Google search can change at any moment, as it did this week. So, right? Like, it's they can do anything they want on their platform, the same way that Instagram can do anything they want on their platform. The rest of us who are renting followers on Instagram on a rented profile, all we can do is complain. And with Google, you see story after story of small publishers or, you know, medium-sized publishers or big publishers saying our traffic tanked because Google changed something. And like, what do you think will happen? This is sort of like the cycle. This keeps happening. So adjusting what you're doing specifically for Google without thinking about long-term sustainable solutions to growing an audience, like that has never worked out. And it's really very bizarre and silly to think that it would now.
We have to take another quick break. We'll be right back.
If you're getting tired of the same old Sunday routine of drinking coffee and doom scrolling, try something new and listen to Crooked Media Podcast Offline with Jon Favreau. Offline is a different kind of Sunday show, a chance to step away from our social media-fueled news cycles and hear smarter, lighter conversations about how our chronically online existence is shaping everything about how we live, work, and interact with the world around us. So put down your screens, grab your headphones, and listen to new episodes of Offline with Jon Favreau every Sunday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Wow, that guy means business.
Just an amazing player.
No, not him. The sports photographer behind him.
What?
He has a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where he earns 5% annual percentage yield. So he's scoring big on and off the field. You might even say he's the MVB.
MVB?
The most valuable business.
Making your money work harder. That's how you business differently. Intuit QuickBooks. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank. Member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Support for this podcast comes from Constant Contact. If you're a business owner, you already know that it's really, really hard to cut through the noise of everyday life. If you want to connect with your customers, you need to break through the noise. You need Constant Contact. Constant Contact is a marketing platform that makes it easy to reach new audiences, grow your customer list, and connect over email, text, social media, and more. Whether you're a marketing guru or just learning the ropes,
Constant Contact offers writing assistance tools and automation features that make it simple to say the right thing at the right time. So get going and start growing your business today with a free trial at ConstantContact.com. Just go to ConstantContact.com right now. Constant Contact, helping the small stand tall. ConstantContact.com.
We're back with Verge Platforms reporter Mia Sato talking about how publishers and platforms are gaming Google to juice click and why that's not really working out for anyone in the long term. Is there another source of traffic? Do you see other people building other ways of getting attention or audiences, like real audiences? Or are we kind of in the traffic moment from your perspective?
I think there are different ways to build an audience that is more sustainable. I'm lucky that I work somewhere that is actually thinking about this. For one of my stories, I spoke with a travel blogger who has one article that is a Pacific Coast Highway guide that is like her golden goose. It brings in tons of traffic. It is the way that I found her, actually. I was asking her, like, what are you doing right now to insulate yourself from something like that article tanking? What if one day it just disappears from the top five Google results for when you search Pacific Coast Highway road trip? Like, what will you do? Her answer was, well, I have a Facebook group with like 30,000 people and I will just post there. I will start a Substack. Or I think she actually maybe has a Patreon or a Substack already, but she was like, that is a way easier, more reliable way to reach people where I can just message them the link, basically, right? And like, they will get it. They aren't having to find me through Google. I'm creating a community around my content that is, you know, outside of something that is algorithmically driven. And I think that is kind of the way that people are moving. Just how can we get people directly to our page? How can we get people to theverge.com every morning? How can we get people to open our emails every day? I think those solutions also probably will have problems and are already, there are some issues. You can't simply rely on that, but the answer is definitely not just produce more content for what people are searching for on Google. I think there are diminishing returns. I think there's also been, you know, now two-ish years of people talking about how bad Google results are and Google actually taking action to try to address some of these concerns. One example is, you know, when people would say, like, I just add Reddit to the end of every search term that I look for. Well, guess what? Google is now pushing people to Reddit forums and Quora, which is hilarious.
Google just signed a deal to ingest Reddit into their AI tools.
Right. So now Google is saying, like, oh, you're putting Reddit at the end of your searches? Bet. Like, we will give you Reddit links. Let's just think for like 2 seconds what will happen next, which is already happening. Where are the SEO people going to go? They're going to go to Reddit until that is also cannibalized and useless. So, yeah, again, very silly to try to format your stuff based on Google in this way and expect that it will sustain you forever.
I keep thinking about the endpoint of Google, which is a bunch of people use Google tools to make AI content on the web, which Google search reads and then generates AI summaries of the AI content. It seems we're already there. That is probably already happening inside of Google search in some meaningful way. There was an infamous tweet by some SEO person who says he stole the sitemap of a rival and generated an entire site using AI, using the rival sitemap, and stole some significant portion of their search traffic. That's bad. Like, I can't imagine the Google search team saw that and thought, this is the right outcome. We would like to incentivize this. But I also don't know how they stop it. You mentioned Google has taken some steps. They just rolled out some updates. What are they trying to do?
They're trying to cut down on this obviously low quality, low effort content that is crowding out results. One thing that they named specifically was obituary spam. This is something I wrote about. This has been a problem for years, I should say also. People working in the funeral industry have known about it for like 15 years. This is not a new issue. But basically, it's like spammy content that is created only to rank, that is maybe, you know, inaccurate, misinformation, whatever. They're also trying to cut down on like domain hijacking, which is you take a site that had good authority in a previous life, something like the Hairpin, you know, this blog, and you spin up a completely new site that is way worse, but is riding on the coattails of, you know, the site that it used to be. It's Google kind of signaling that they don't want this content here. The changes won't come into effect for a bit, so we're not quite sure how this will work. I'm very curious, though, if, you know, someone in your life who doesn't have a public profile died in, you know, whenever after these algorithm updates are in effect, what would Google show? Because the whole argument that Google gave me when I wrote my story was, well, when there's nothing to show, when there aren't that many results, like, it will pull bad stuff. That is pretty, that's like this data void concept. So if there's still not great results in 3 months when these updates happen, like, what will Google show? Will it say, sorry, I can't fulfill this search query? Like, no, they're not going to do that. So yeah, we'll see.
That is an incredible argument. I just want to point out the argument that it is impermissible for Google search to say, I don't know the answer, or there isn't enough data, is crazy. Like, just like on its face, the idea that a data void exists, so Google's bad and that's not our fault, is, I think, exactly a symptom of Google not wanting to be responsible for what it shows people, right? We can only show you what's there is like, or you could not show people anything, right? And all the other big algorithmic platforms are aware, like maybe sometimes too much aware, like Meta on Threads will not let you search for COVID information. They just don't want to be a part of it. And they're like, we're just blocking this out. I think the Gaza situation, I think a lot of big platforms would just like to make that go away. They don't want to talk about it. Google search can't do that, right? Like, people search on Google for news. They search on Google for health information. Google has a responsibility there. But it seems like they want that responsibility to end at, we pointed you to something else. But in the age of AI, in the age of search generative results, in the age of AI competitors who will just answer the question, the pressure on Google to actually have the answer is going up. And I wonder if you've noticed any amount of reflection from Google or change in Google as it thinks about search, where it recognizes the pressure to actually have the answer and be responsible for the answer is going up.
I think over the years, Google has tried to raise the bar for results. So all of this stuff like buying guides, credit card information, health information, that all falls under a special category that Google has designated as being like not high risk, but if you get bad information, it could negatively impact your life. It's called Your Money, Your Life. So content that is Your Money, Your Life needs to have there's a higher bar for what Google is looking for. So it tries to do, you know, things like that. I think the addition of another E in the EAT, I think they added experience, which I should say that some SEO people were pissed about, because they were like, how could we show experience? It's impossible to show that we tested all of these things before we wrote about them, which is also like a very funny thing to like be obvious about. Like, you kind of are saying the quiet part out loud. So, you know, I think Google has introduced these different ways that it wants to evaluate content. But we should say, too, that, like, again, it's Google being the arbiter of whether something is trustworthy, whether something is good, and often it fails at that job. Google is not fact-checking these things. Google is not doing investigative journalism into whether CNET's newsroom is being pressured to write content that is more friendly to advertisers. We are, though. Like, we're doing that. And my question that I've asked Google multiple times is, like, do you see what people are writing about? Do you see our work? Do you see other outlets' work about this AI-generated garbage? And do you care? How is that incorporated into your results? And they can never answer. They don't want to say. So I think there's this question of, like, what does the Google search feedback loop look like? What kind of signals are they looking for to evaluate whether something is good or whether it is bad? When stuff like obituary spam happens, it's very obvious that, like, oh, you're just not checking this at all. Like, you don't care.
I really think that there's a tension between two halves of Google right now, the part that's racing ahead with AI and the part that is contending with the world that AI is building. And I don't know that the search part can say, hey, AI is bad for this product right now, because it is in direct conflict with the other part of Google. And I think that kind of brings me to my last question here. If search is the last source of traffic for websites, and this sort of tense relationship under the table between the people who make the websites, the SEO professionals, the content farmers, and Google is sort of coming out in the open, right? Is Google just doomed? Like, there's a part of me that says they cannot resolve that tension.
they're pissing everyone off, which is, I think, an important part of this. Like, people who operate websites are pissed. People who search for things are pissed. There is a real, like, question of how will we find things online? Will we become further entrenched into these little bubbles that we're in, into, you know, the Discord communities or the Patreon chats or whatever it is, into, you know, our own little group chats, our own Instagram DMs? And, like, how bad does Google have to get? How much do the results have to degrade for us to just be like, actually, this isn't worth my time to search for? If Google is as bad as we say it is, and it's going to get worse, or people are just going to keep pushing more AI-generated garbage into the ecosystem, then where are we going? I think that's sort of the question that, like, users have to answer. I pretty much, like, find restaurant recommendations in Brooklyn exclusively on TikTok now at this point. Google Maps is not helpful for me. Google Search is even worse because it's just Yelp. My habits have changed. My usage has changed. And I mean, Google still has, like, an incredible monopoly on search. So I don't think that this is something that will happen overnight. But there's a new generation of people on the internet who Google search has always sucked for them. So, you know, there's no reason for them to be loyal to this or to keep, you know, kicking this dead horse. They can just go to TikTok.
This feels as good of a place to end it. Thank you so much for coming on, Mia.
Thank you. This is so fun.
Thanks again to Verge Platforms reporter Mia Sato for joining us on the show. Next time you're wondering why your Google search results are so bad, go read her reporting on it. It's very good. If you have thoughts about this episode or want to tell us what you'd like to hear more of, you can email us at decoder@theverge.com. We really do read all the emails and we love them. You can also hit me up directly on Threads. I'm @reckless1280. We also have a TikTok. Check it out. It's @decoderpod. It's a lot of fun. If you like Decoder, please share it with your friends. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you really love the show, give us that 5-star review. Decoder is a production of The Verge and part of the Vox Media Podcast Network. Today's episode was produced by Kate Cox and Nick Stat. It was edited by Kelly Wright. Our supervising producer is Liam James. The Decoder music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. We'll see you next time.